The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
When Nicole Sandler sits down to do her show, she's the producer, booking the guests, pulling the audio, planning the show, the engineer, running the controls, troubleshooting any problems, playing the sounds, calling the guests, and she's the webmaster, writing the blog, posting the podcast, maintaining the website, not to mention the host, interviewing the guests, explaining the issues, giving opinions, and calling out the bad guys. And then you get the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
Howdy, folks. Mangy Fetlocks here. Trump's looking for a creditor, the poor sexual predator. He needs about a half a billion bucks. He needs to pay a sort of fine. Initially, Donald Trump was trying to raise it from his group of stupid friends. Chance grows greater by the hour. They'll come and claim his favorite tower. That's sure to leave him angry and depressed. He was the dumbest in his class. Now karma's bit him on the ass with H.E. James. He never should have messed. Trump's nothing but a failionaire with orange skin and tinted hair and way less money than he claimed he had. I'm thinking now he may be screwed and his bid for power not renewed, but somehow I don't find this story sad.
Oh.
Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you, Mangy Fetlocks, Bruce W. Nelson, getting us started on a Tuesday. It's just Tuesday, right? My God. Too much is happening too quickly with, not enough downtime. Anyway, welcome to the show. Today, you know what, is March 26th. So Women's History Month is not over yet. And, we have a tradition around these parts for Women's History Month. So our old friend Amy Simon will be here shortly. Actually, we taped this conversation over the weekend because there's an echo. Really? All right. See, here's the deal. I switched out computers last night. You guys really have an echo? Is it not just, I want to know that it's more than just Ed the Second. Anybody else hearing an echo? Okay. If I don't hear if one person says echo, I can't trust it. If more than one person says echo, then I know I have a problem. All right. No one else is saying it. So Ed, I think it's you. Fingers crossed. Anyway, when I hit the recording, we'll see if there's an echo. But anyway, I digress. So it's been a crazy couple of days, right? What else is new? The morning began with a freighter crashing into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, which collapsed. There's video of it everywhere. I'm not going to play it now, but you've seen it. Or you should see it. It's frightening. You are hearing an echo. Okay, hold on. Let me try to figure out why. Damn. Well, you know what? I'm gonna figure out why anyway. Hold on. It's always something. It's not one thing. It's another. Why is there an echo? Echo. I'm gonna try to do one thing. Hold on, sound settings. Yeah, see, it's times like this that I really could use a real producer, but okay, maybe this? No. All right, so I switched out computers, and maybe that's why. No. Damn it. I don't know why. All right. I'm not going to talk long. So you know what? I'm going to bring Amy on sooner than later. And hopefully there's no echo on Amy. And I guess I know what I'm doing tonight. But yesterday I asked the question, will Rachel Maddow go there? Will she criticize? I sound clear. It's just poor acoustics. Okay. Sounds like I'm broadcasting from a tin can. Jesus. I don't know why. But I'm going to bring Amy on in like 5 minutes. So if you can bear with me for 5 minutes, hopefully the tape sounds better. Because I did it, I think, before I switched computers. More echo now Now there's the echo. Okay, so I tried to change something. Live radio, isn't it fun? All right, hold on. Oh, that's the wrong thing. I got to go to my sound settings. So I did switch out computers because the other one, there's something going on. So now I went back to this computer and I'm having sound issues. Damn it, damn it, damn it. How about if I do, it's not even going to let me do that. Well, let me go here? No. Uses default. How about this one? I don't know. Hopefully, tell me if that's any better. It actually got a little worse. Lovely. All right, you know what? Then I'll save it for after. Let's go to Amy now, and I'll mess with the sound settings, and hopefully this will all work. But before I do, I'll just say, Rachel Maddow made us proud last night. She was brilliant. She explained all the reasons why this Ronna McDaniel hiring was so offensive, because Ronna McDaniel put the power of the Republican Party behind what should be a fringe, nothing candidate who would be forgotten to history. But instead, Ronna McDaniel went along with it. And no, I don't have speakers on. Ronna McDaniel went along with it and therefore made it so Donald Trump might not just fall into the time warps of history where other fascist dictator wannabes have fallen. So to be continued. All right. So because my sound is foobar, now it's less. Okay. Well, I'm going to cross my fingers that the recording is better than the live thing. And I will continue tweaking. Damn. And I thought I fixed it. Ugh, shit.
It's time for Amy Simon of She's History, the most dangerous women in American history, then and now.
Because I'm a woman, and I'm a man, that's all.
It is March, still under the wire, we made it. That means it's still Women's History Month. And finally, we get my friend Amy Simon here, because we can't go through a Women's History Month without gathering together to talk women. So Amy Simon of sheshistory.com. Hi.
Happy
Women's History Month.
Yeah, well, you know.
We've been busy. Now, we've been doing this for many, many years. You've been doing it for even longer. I guess for, you know, we're always having new people join the show. So for those who don't know, Amy Simon is an old dear friend of mine who, when we met, you were a record promotion rep in Los Angeles. And we met over music. But you were also a mom. In fact, when we met, your daughter Rose, who just celebrated a birthday, was just born.
Yep.
Far back we go.
Yeah, and that's what inspired all of my playwriting and, you know, women's history and motherhood work. Yeah.
Yes. And so when you left the music industry, which you did to be a stay-at-home mom, then you had another daughter, so two daughters, and you always dabbled in theater. That's your first love, right?
Well, I more than dabbled, first of all, but I'd like to go back a little bit. Okay. When I left the music industry, it was not of my own volition. Oh. When I got pregnant, I got laid off.
Ah, lovely.
And I got mad and I sued and I won. And I'm not like, it was so many years ago, so I won't mention any particulars because there was a legal thing. But let me just say, I had just gotten a review of how great my work was. And then all of a sudden I was pregnant and gotta go. So I did what I had to do and heard from women afterwards that they were treated better because of what I did. So that was the first like great thing that happened from getting pregnant.
Okay. Then you had a second daughter and out of your motherhood experience grew your first one woman show that ran in LA for many, many years called Cheerios in My Underwear.
And Other True Tales of Motherhood.
There you go. And the name sort of explains what it was. It was funny and it was moving, but it also talked about the tax that women pay for being a woman, for having kids.
Right. And that's when my library at home started with one book was The Price of Motherhood, Why the Most Important Job in the World is Still the Least Valued. Mm-hmm. And another book called The Feminine Mistake, which is a play on words of the seminal 1960s, The Feminine Mystique. But it was all very eye-opening, and it really did lead me down the road of research about the role of mothers and women. And I was, you know, a feminist. I took one of the first women's studies courses in college, and I was a feminist, but not really understanding what it meant to really be a woman until I had a baby and I stopped getting a paycheck and I became invisible and all other kinds of, but, and I say this in both of my plays, it was the first time in my life that I knew I was doing really important work. What I did really mattered. I couldn't screw up because that's, you know, the consequences are, although also, you know, if you do great, you as a mother, you get all the credit. But if your kid screws up, you get all the blame. There's really no winning.
Right. No, there isn't. And on top of that, as you said, the most undervalued profession, because as you learned after your divorce, all the work you did as a stay-at-home mom counts for, I can use this term because we're on the internet, jack shit.
Yeah.
When it comes to Social Security and your future.
Right. I had no clue whatsoever about the economic and financial cost of motherhood and of being women. You know, statistics, they're all in the top of my head, but, you know, divorced mothers are one of the largest poverty groups in America.
Wow.
And one of the quotes from The Price of Motherhood, the Ann Crittenden, and just to give a, you know, Ann Crittenden was a, let me see if I can remember. She was a Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist. She was the financial reporter for the New York Times and the, you know, she was well known. She left the paid workforce to have a baby. Mm-hmm. And after she became a mother, she ran into someone she knew who said to her, "Didn't you used to be Ann Crittenden?"
Oh.
So this is the kind of stuff I was reading and was just incredibly enlightening. And she said, stay-at-home moms are the largest unpaid labor force in America. Mm-hmm. So there was just so much to learn. You don't get paid for being a mother unless you do it for another family. If you take care of another family, and nannies get to write off their income. But when you're a stay-at-home parent, you know, man or woman, mother or father, you don't. I didn't know that I went for 13 years without putting a penny into my Social Security. That was like eye-opening. So much of it was eye-opening. And then the divorce really led me to writing about women's history. So,
well, yeah. The divorce did, but also your daughters were a little more grown and they're in school. And one of them brought home an assignment was it for Women's History Month?
It was Women's History Month. It was Rose. And she was, you know, I think 10. And she said, "I'm going to do my women's history report on Cher or Janet Jackson." And, you know, I kind of freaked out. So that was a big part of the inspiration of the show. And as I say in the play, Rose got by me and she did her. First of all, it was insane that she was allowed to do her women's history. She did it on Janet Jackson.
Oh, God.
But Ruby, my younger daughter, 4 years younger, she did hers on the first woman to run for president, Victoria Woodhull. So yeah. I did have some good impact. But, yeah.
Yeah. So what that grew into was She's History. It was a one woman show. It's still in various incarnations. You've done a number of different versions of it over the years, right?
Well, I've done the solo show. Mm-hmm. I opened it in 2010 at the Skirball Cultural Center in LA on Mother's Day.
Yeah.
And I will share that when I first started doing the show, I would ask these questions to the audience, like, "Who said I have a brain and a uterus and I use them both?" Which is funny. You know, I always try to be funny and kind of funny. And that's a line from Pat Schroeder, who was the first woman that Colorado sent to Congress. Mm-hmm. And I would have a bowl of chocolate kisses. This was my little device. And I thought every time someone answered the question correctly, I'd give them a chocolate kiss. Now, this was the first time I did the show. So I asked that question. There was a woman in the front row who answered it, gave her a kiss. I asked another who said, "When you're at work, you think of the children you've left at home. When you're at home, you think of the work you've left unfinished. Such a struggle is unleashed within yourself. Your heart is rent." And that was Golda Meir. And she knew that. And everything I said, I just gave her the whole bowl of chocolate.
Oh, my God.
It was so funny. Turns out she was the women's history professor at Harvard Westlake. Her name is Martha Wheelock. We've been friends ever since. She did a documentary about women voting in California, put me in it. She was just at my, I just did a show 2 weeks ago at the E-Bell of Los Angeles, which I want to talk to you about. That's women's
sign over your right shoulder. Yep. Yeah. We'll talk about that in a moment.
No, this is not the
different show.
This is a different show. This is my newest show. We'll get there.
Yes.
But the point is that the show attracts people like a Martha Wheelock, who's the women's history, you know, people just, I've performed for Gloria Steinem. I'm like the highlight of my life. By the way, Gloria Steinem is
still right behind you too, right?
Yeah, that's
you and
yeah,
Gloria.
That's there us. Yeah? I know. Kvelling, because I met Gloria and she gave me the greatest line from my play, one of the greatest lines. This picture was taken. She did a fundraiser. I was invited to it because I can't afford to go to those things. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had met her once before and I knew where she was. So I kind of stalked through the backstage area. And this was about 2008, right when Hillary was running with Sarah Palin. And so Gloria comes out and I'm chit-chatting with her. And I don't know how it came up, but she gave me this line. The only thing Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin have in common is a chromosome. Mm-hmm.
There you
and
go.
I use that's it, I use it in the show.
Yeah.
Gloria Steinem is going to be 90 years old next week. Her birthday is March 31st.
Wow. Well, this week, because we're taping Saturday, actually, and this is going to run Tuesday, the 26th. Yes. So this week, the end of the week.
Yeah.
So 90 years ago. Good for her. And yeah, she's an icon. And so, all right. So
I've been doing the solo show for many years and I started working on a full cast version of it because my whole goal is to get the stories of the women out there, and doing a solo show is not that easy. And right. Doing a full cast version that I've created that has 12 actresses playing all the roles. It's four centuries. We go from Abigail Adams to today. And we mention all kinds of people in it. The premise of it is a mom and her two daughters. Throughout the play, the mom is enlightening her daughters. They go on sort of a tour and they go back in time. So we see scenes with Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Yeah. We see scenes with everybody. And a lot of it is about the Equal Rights Amendment and the 19th Amendment has a big role, which is the suffrage amendment, which was called the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, which took forever. We finally passed it in 1920. So we had the anniversary during the pandemic and kind of didn't get to celebrate as much as we like. But I've also done little scenes, little 10-minute plays. You know, today doing theater is so hard. And so to produce a ambitious play like She Is History, the full cast version, you know, it's just to pay actresses and it's just a big deal. I haven't been able to get anyone to do it, but I've taken little 10-minute versions out of it. Scenes with Bella Abzug and her daughter, scenes with Susan B. Anthony, you know, 10-minute bits. So just right. Anything to get the stories out there. So.
You also wanted to do a school version to get into schools and to, you know, to have it out there. And that has been a struggle all these years.
I have versions. You're correct. I did a version, like a 45-minute version for the Henry Street Settlement in New York City. Now, for those who don't know, Lillian Wald, an amazing fantastic actor, activist. She's the person who brought school nurses in. She brought nurses into public schools. She was born in the late 1800s, and in the early 1900s, she helped develop a community in the tenements of New York City, where, you know, the tenements. And she didn't know anything about them. The way it happened was she was teaching a class on nursing, and one of her students came into class late and said, "My mom is really sick. Can you please come and help her?" So Lillian Wald goes through the tenements to this woman's home for the first time amid the stink and the stench and the horror of it. And she right then had her epiphany, talked a rich man into giving her a home right in the center of it all. And she created the Henry Street Settlement, which exists today. That's where the Neighborhood Playhouse is. And, you know, the Hull House in Chicago, Jane Addams created the Hull House. She won a Nobel Peace Prize for it. They didn't know each other. Like, just, you know, women think of smart things together. So I mentioned I ended up doing a fourth grade class. That's the youngest group I've performed for. Mm-hmm. Because I developed part of it in Ruby, my younger daughter, when she was in middle school. She had a really cool teacher, David Foldbury. So I created a version and I did improv versions of it and, you know, school versions. I've done several schools. I've done Girl Scouts. So I leave some stuff out some stuff out when I do senior homes because their attention span isn't quite. So
right.
Each week I adjust. I make it all work.
You do. So you've had this show going on, and though it hasn't gotten a widespread production, and I guess to get into, what is it that you need a play to get into for it to be distributed?
Okay, so first, to be published in like a Samuel French publishing, you need to have a run in a major theater. In Los Angeles, to do a 6-week run in a theater, it costs $100,000. You need to pay actors, you need to pay scene designers, rent a theater, and then you need to rent you need to pay a publicist, because you can't do it without an audience. Yeah, it's just, it's so hard.
Right. So that hasn't happened, but you did attract the interest of a publisher who is having you write a book, which you've been working on for a while.
I know. I'm sitting in my office because I work full time, which allows me to do all my, and I get this email from Rowan and Littlefield Publishing. Hi, we found you on the Women's Media Center. So I have been a women's history expert on something called the Women's Media Center. They have an arm of it called She Source. So if you, Nicole, want to find an expert in a woman expert, you would go to that. It started with Jane Fonda, Gloria Steinem, and Robin Morgan. These are the three women that created Women's Media Center. I've been on it for 15 years. Nobody ever... So I'm sitting in my office drinking my coffee, and I get this email saying, I saw She's History caught my eye. Would you consider writing a young adult women's history book? So I thought, oh, somebody put acid in my coffee. This is like a dream. Like, this can't be real.
Right.
And yeah, and it's real. So I've been working on it now for about 2 years. It took a while for us to figure out what we were going to do, because it's young adult. And I have not written for young adult. I've performed. So it's... Yeah, so the working title is 5 Centuries of Women, Trailblazing Women Activists. And so, and then choosing, I'm doing little biographies. They're not that little, actually, because I can't just talk a little bit about each woman. It takes me about a month just to do one. And then to choose who I get to put in it, because there's a certain word count. It's like, who are your favorite children? It's
right. Yeah, but it's exciting. I know it's tedious and it's hard work and it's something different, but challenging and rewarding, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
So is there an ETA on when you are supposed to have it?
Yeah. I've extended the deadline twice, and I think it's going to be April of 2026, actually.
April, so after Women's History Month?
So here's how it works. I have to turn it in 9-10 months before Women's History Month.
Right.
That's how long it takes them to do their bit. So right. I'll be done with the book, and then it takes almost a year to get it put together, because we're shooting for, obviously, for March for Women's History Month. So there's all kinds of stuff with publishing that I didn't know anything about that now I do. So it'll be there, and it'll be there.
Yes, and I can't wait. So we have that to look forward to. Now, Amy Simon, so in addition to She's History and She Is History and the different versions in the book, I see over your right shoulder, Bella Abzug. And that was another play you did. Tell us about this one.
Yeah, when I started working on She's History, and most of the women are not with us anymore, including Bella Abzug. So, I found and I knew who Bella Abzug was, but I found a commercial online of her. And, for someone doing
Express commercial,
the American Express commercial. So for your listeners who don't remember, back in the 70s, American Express had a campaign with celebrities, and it would be like Carl Malden and like, do you know me? Well, I carry an American Express card. So Bella Abzug did a commercial, a parody of it. Do you know me? Well, American Express did not know me, because when I was in the Congress of the United States and I applied for an American Express card, they told me I had to get my husband to sign for it. So I'm like, oh my God, it was so great. And I didn't know that Bella Abzug is the one that created the legislation so that we can have credit cards. She created the Equal Opportunity Credit Law. She pushed that through Congress. Wow. And when I would do my show, even today when I do my show, older women will come up to me and said, I could not get a mortgage. I could not get a bank account. I just read something on Facebook, because something came up about it, for Women's History Month, that her mom, when she was young, her mom couldn't get a bank account without her father's signature, and her father was dead. So the point I'm making is that Bella Abzug did many wonderful things, and that was one of women in the 1970s, the things women couldn't serve on a jury, couldn't sign for their own home, couldn't get a credit, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah.
And
I started researching her, and as I was doing She's History, I was working on another, you know, on my Bella Abzug solo play. And I finally kind of got it up last Sunday at my theater. I did a polished stage reading of it, and now I actually have a Bella Abzug play. But what's interesting about Bella Abzug is many things. Harvey Fierstein wrote a play about Bella Abzug many years ago. I learned about that. I actually have it in my bookcase. I won't read it because I'm still not completely done with mine. But he wrote, it's called Bella Bella. And here's the premise of his play. It's set in 1977, Bella Abzug ran for mayor. She got elected to Congress in 1970, and she served starting in 1971. But she ran for mayor, and she lost. So the play is set. She's in a hotel room in Manhattan in the bathroom, and all her friends are in her room waiting for her to come out and do her acceptance speech. So he set the whole play in the bathroom.
Oh, wow.
And he plays Bella, and he wasn't supposed to play. He wasn't supposed to. That was not the plan. They asked Bette Midler and Patti LuPone and a few other people. They just couldn't get the actress, so he ended up doing it. And I watched a trailer of it. I mean, I love Harvey Fierstein. He's great. So I kind of put, and that was 2019. Then the pandemic came, and I was doing lots of women's history stuff online. I did a show for my theater, which people can watch if you go to theaterwest.org. It's called Speechifying, and all on Zoom. My director Karen Reagan George directed the actresses. We had 12 women. I curated all the speeches from Abigail Adams, starting with Abigail Adams, to Kamala Harris. And I had really great actresses perform their speeches. That's what we did for Women's History Month in 2020 during the pandemic, or it might have been 2021.
Right.
So his play is still out there, but I put mine down. I thought Harvey's got his, I'm doing this. And then my theater asked me, and I've been bringing it into workshop all these years. We have a wonderful writing workshop at my theater company, Theater West in Los Angeles. Uh-huh. It's operating theater in Los Angeles, and I would bring it in and they would help me tweak it. And then like 2 months ago, my friend at Theater West, who runs the company, said, Amy, we need something for Women's History Month. I said, I can't do She's History again. I've done 5 fundraisers.
Right.
So I called my director, Karen Reagan George. I said, she's in Atlanta. I said, can you direct me? And we worked on it for the past month. As soon as I put down the show, the She's History show, and I did it last Sunday, and people loved it. So I have a really good new play.
Awesome. So is it set in the bathroom?
No. So this play is set, it's completely different than Harvey's play. Sure. The opening line, she's on the phone, Bella, Ms. Bella, yelling at American Express because she's like, do you know who I am? Do you mean to tell me a woman can't get a credit card without a husband's signature? Can you tell me why you can't? Well, what if she doesn't have a husband? What then? Oh, you don't know. Who does know? All right. Yeah, whatever. And then she talks to the audience. So we see her in her Washington, D.C. office. Most of the play is set there, but we go back in time. She's on the phone with everybody, with her daughter, with Gloria Steinem. She's planning marches. She's yelling at the congressmen. She is, as I say in the play, surrounded by schlemiels. And working on the Equal Rights Amendment. That's a big thread. In the night, they ratified a lot of it in the, I know, Lynn, I see your face, the Equal Rights Amendment.
I know, we'll get it.
It was originally called the Lucretia Mott Amendment, by the way, and it was written in 1923 by Alice Paul and Crystal Eastman. That's how long it's been around. And as I say in the play, every year since 1923, Congress has heard the words of the Equal Rights Amendment and rejected them. So anyway, so that's part of the play. She goes through the whole play, and then off to the side twice she'll address the House of Representatives. So I go over to the podium and I talk about the draft, and Bella Abzug was the first congressperson, one of the first to ask for Nixon's impeachment. And I do a scene where she meets him and she's yelling at him and saying, my constituents are not happy that we're still in Vietnam. And he's like, and he's like, you're not doing a very good job. Bella would just tell off everyone. So that's the play. And we go back in time once to 1949, when Bella Abzug went down to Mississippi, Laurel, Mississippi. This is a true story. And it's just like To Kill a Mockingbird. A black man, Willie McGee, was convicted of raping a white woman. They actually had consensual affair, but he was convicted and was going to be put to death, and nobody would defend him. And Bella Abzug was a labor lawyer. She actually stood up to Joseph McCarthy. She defended a lot of the Hollywood people. So she, when she was campaigning, she'd have Barbara Streisand and Marlon Shirley MacLaine and all those, you know, wonderful women helping her because she defended them during McCarthy. So she just, you know, she was just so ballsy. Anyway, she goes down to Laurel, Mississippi to defend Willie McGee. 8 months pregnant. She couldn't get a hotel room. She was followed around. Her life was literally threatened. She had a miscarriage, lost her baby.
At 8 months?
Yeah, it's horrible. So I do a whole scene now in the play where she goes down, and this is also in the full cast version. So now it's in my solo play where she's being followed by the sheriff. She goes to the bus station. She's on the phone with her, with Martin, her husband, and she's talking about, and then she loses the baby. It's a very powerful scene, but it's true. It's, and it's the similar, and Willie McGee died in the electric chair, and there's a newspaper headline. This is all real. We should, you know, they should burn Bella Abzug along with Willie McGee. I mean, this was the South in the 1950s. So the play has a lot of serious stuff, but a lot of really funny stuff too, because you need sugar with your medicine, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, humor is what I think helps propel any message. That's why, Jon Stewart back on The Daily Show.
I know.
Right? So that's the kind that, because that kind of news cuts through when you give it with a spoonful of sugar or a few laughs. And that's why that works. Now, so will the book have a humorous bent to it, or it's going to be more serious?
Yeah. As I'm sending stuff to my editor, and I just love saying that it's more fun than saying my cardiologist or something like that. Right? I'm I have to be a little more careful because it's for like ninth graders and up.
Right.
So, but yeah, I have a mentor in New York, Lenore DeCoven. She's been mentoring me forever. She's a wonderful director. And she says, Amy, don't lose your voice. Don't let them take your voice. So it's tricky, but I think, I do think I'm still like, I have a line. I haven't sent this particular chapter. Victoria Woodhull was the first woman to run for president in 1872.
Sorry, Victoria Woodhull. I mean, I learned it from you. I never heard her name before you started on this journey, but now she's my favorite women from history.
Yeah, she's really amazing. She ran for president in 1872. She grew up very poor. She was conceived, as she says, during the frenzy of the, I'm going to space on it now, the religious fervor of that era of the 1930s, when the preachers would come to town and they would have all this fervent preaching. They still do it today, but but she grew up with a horrible, horrible family situation. And I say, look, and she was also beautiful, very, very smart. She was only educated to the third grade, but she would speak to the spirits. I mean, if you want to believe that stuff, and people do, she would and spiritualism was really big in those days. Mm-hmm. And it also happened to be at the same time as the Morse code. So for the first time, people understood that you could send things through the air. So it wasn't such a stretch to see that. And she was such a performer, which, of course, prepared her for a life in politics. But she was brilliant, and her father would just take her around the country when she was 10 years old, and her sister, both of them, and they would do hands-on healing, and the mom was nuts, and she would create these healing things for cancer, which was just like alcohol and drugs, and it was a really, she grew up in a horrible situation. And then the Civil War came, she ends up in New York, and she becomes friends with Cornelius Vanderbilt, the richest man in America.
Right.
So she became his financial advisor, and her sister, Tennessee, was beautiful, became his sort of concubine. The two of them were very much in his world. So I can talk for an hour about this, so I'll try to get to the important points. They end up becoming very rich from Vanderbilt, and they open the first female stock brokerage firm on Wall Street. And they get very popular, very famous, but she decides to run for president. Meanwhile, she was known as the prostitute who ran for president because they would go around the country taking care of men. Uh-huh. But this also informed her on the role of women, the subjugation and the oppression and, what could they do? So she used what she had. And when they got to
But the part that she was a prostitute, right? And she would take the pillow talk, the things that she heard.
Okay, I'm getting there. So when she gets married. I forgot that. She's 15 years old, exhausted from being overworked by her father. And they get a doctor, Dr. Canning Woodhull. Her name was Victoria Claflin. And she marries this 28-year-old abusive alcoholic doctor. She gives birth at the age of 16 alone to a baby boy named Byron, born with special needs. They end up moving to San Francisco. This is during the gold rush. Okay. And boy, she couldn't get a job. In those days, you could either be a teacher or a nurse. She had no education. So she ends up being a seamstress. There's an actress that has her sew her dresses and says, "You're beautiful. You could get a job as an actress." Victoria Woodhull also could memorize anything. She's on the stage in San Francisco. And that's when the whole prostitution, because back then women didn't just perform. So that's when it all came back to haunt her when she gets to New York. Now, in New York in the 1850s, after the Civil War, there were like literally 50,000 hookers, prostitutes, women who they didn't know how to support themselves. And Victoria and her sister were in New York, and they would take care of the women. They would give them salves and medicine and treat their bodies. And the women would service the Wall Street men. They would hear them talking about their stocks, and they would share it with Victoria. So Victoria would sit with Cornelius Vanderbilt and go into a trance and say, "Buy this stock, buy that stock." And, you know, like, you can't make this stuff up. This is like crazy. And she ends up very rich and privileged. She has she has a newspaper called the Woodhull Claflin Weekly. And she runs for president, and her platform is free love. And she believes in free love, and she espouses free love. And then it all comes tumbling down because, you know, she was a detriment to the, at first she was a friend of the women's movement, but then she was too radical. She was the first person in America to publish Karl Marx's manifesto in English. And then she uses her newspaper to out the most popular and powerful preacher, Henry Ward Beecher. He was who's the guy today who's got the big Joel
Osteen?
Yeah, he was like that.
Yeah.
And she outs him because he was a serial adulterer. He was having an affair with one of his parishioners' wives, and puts it all in the newspaper. Now, back then, there was something called the Comstock Law, where you could not share information about birth control or anything like that. And she outed him, and she would also talk, and so they put her in jail on Election Day. And when I'm writing my chapter for Roman in Littlefield, and I say Victoria Woodhull to talk about my comedy voice, I say this in my play, Victoria Woodhull pulled herself up and out of poverty, I like to say, by her bra straps. So that's the kind of thing. I don't know if it's going to go over for the young, but I hope it does. But yeah, her story, I mean, then she ends up in jail, I mean, homeless on the street. And then, yeah, it was bad. It was really bad. They all turned on her, everyone. She was written right out of the book. She caused a fight between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, with whom she was friends for a while. But she was just too radical. At one point, she was living with her husband, her ex-husband, and sleeping with her biographer. I mean, she was such a badass.
You know, she belonged in the 1960s. And yeah.
Well, she ended up being... when Vanderbilt died, his son knew that Victoria and Tennessee Claflin, they had so much info that he gave them like $100,000, said, just leave the country, okay? And so they go to England, and they both marry like royalty and have this amazing life at the end of their life. And Victoria Woodhull ended up, you know, doing philanthropic work and, you know... just, you know, surviving and thriving. But she really struggled.
Europe back then was not as easy as, you know, we can just hop on a plane and go. That's a journey on a ship, right?
Yeah, sure is. So, but, you know, she made it. Her sister became Lady Tennessee, and Victoria married a wealthy banker and had a beautiful home. And like I said, she would care for the poor and give money to the poor. You know, she really did want to do good.
Right.
And the fact that she escaped this really crazy, like nutty, religiously fanatic, abusive childhood, it was really tragic. And I'm always drawn to these women who either turn their life around like her or have a platform like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and use their platform for good. So that's what all my stuff's about.
Okay. I've got a question for you that's been, you know, just curiosity for me. Why is Susan B. Anthony a right-wing hero?
Okay, she's not a right-wing hero. Uh-huh. The right-wingers just took her name and made it. She was not a right-wing at all.
I think so, right.
She was all about suffrage. She was, I don't think she was pro-abortion at the time. That might be the only thing that she might have in common with today's. But she was definitely, she was as progressive as you can be. And people think she was a lesbian. Who knows? She was engaged once. She was also a Quaker. Now, the Quakers were like, I could never be a Quaker because a Quaker is never idle. They don't dance. There's no music. There's no makeup. They don't get dressed nice. So, but they did great things. The Quakers were actually, they educated their women. They were the first group in America to ban slavery. They were pretty awesome, to be honest. And so she met a man who was a Quaker, but he drank. So she broke up with him. So I like to tell that story because people think she was this straight-laced, horrible. She wasn't. You know, she was just a regular woman, but because she grew up during what was called the Panic of 1837 and her family lost all their money, so they had to create a new business where her father had a boarding house and they were like all these women that worked for him. And guess who took care of everything? Susan B. She cooked, she cleaned, she did laundry, she watched babies. And that's why she said she was never going to marry and become a drudge and have to live with a man, you know, take care of a man. So that's why she never married. Huh. Not because she knew what it would be like. And so she made her life's, thank God she did her life's work. And her partnership with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, which is the greatest partnership in women's history. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton was born rich, privileged. Her cousin, Gerrit Smith, was one of the richest men in the country. His house was a stop on Harry Tubman's Underground Railroad. And so Elizabeth was educated. Susan was educated as well, but she was not privileged like Elizabeth. And the two of them met, thank God, because they were five. Elizabeth was 5 years older. So Elizabeth had all these babies. She really enjoyed sex, too. This is the, one of the things that I like about my, what I put in my play, is that you never think of these women as sexual creatures. Oh. But she, when she got married and she would write in her diary that she was enjoying the pleasures of the flesh. And then when she finds out her husband, her new husband, wasn't really a women's rights activist, she was like, no more pleasures of the flesh for him. Mm-mm. So stuff like that. But the two of them made the greatest partnership because Susan would come to Elizabeth's home and she had all these babies and her husband was always gone. He was an anti-slavery agent. And the women actually learned how to organize from the abolitionist movement. And Susan was at a temperance meeting in Seneca Falls where Elizabeth lived. And temperance was, you know, no alcohol. And that led to the abolition movement, which led to the women's movement. They learned to organize from working on all these movements. So Susan would come to Elizabeth's house and take care of the kids and stir the puddings. Puddings were this giant meal in the middle of the living room. And Elizabeth would write the speeches. Susan would go off and make them. And the line was, I stir the puddings, I stir you up, you stir the puddings, and together we stir up the world. That's what Elizabeth Cady Stanton's husband would say about them. And that's what they did. And then once Elizabeth's children grew up and she was an empty nester, then she went on the road with Susan. They moved to Manhattan. They had their own newspaper called The Revolution. Oh. Susan gets arrested for voting for president. And in 1972, Victoria Woodhull ran for president. And right. Victoria Woodhull voted for Ulysses S. Grant, who was the most corrupt until now president in history. She didn't vote for Victoria Woodhull.
Why?
Because they had this big rift.
Oh, God. And wasn't Victoria Woodhull's running mate Frederick Douglass?
Well, she asked him to be her running mate. And that's, she did, but we don't know. He didn't. We don't know if he ever knew it, if he ever rejected it, but she definitely wanted him to be her running mate.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, see, the stories are wonderful, and I never learned any of this stuff. We had Eleanor Roosevelt and
Amelia Earhart,
Susan
B. Anthony, right? There's like the five,
right? So your kids, you know, doing a report on Cher. Well, there weren't many. We were not taught about these women.
Yeah,
there's still a dearth of information about them. If you say Elizabeth Cady Stanton, I'd say 90% of the people would have no idea who you're talking about. And I'm probably being generous.
And I have to tell you, a couple weeks ago, I've done my She's History show. There's a club in Los Angeles called the Ebel of Los Angeles. This was a women's club founded in 1894 for women, a cultural and educational center. It's wonderful. I got to perform there. So Spectrum News here, they found me and they decided to do a piece on me. So I'm speaking to the producer on the phone and she's asking me to explain the play. So I'm trying to explain the play. I'm like, well, you know, like Gloria Steinem. She's like, I said, do you mind me asking? She didn't know who she was. I said, do you mind?
She didn't know who Gloria Steinem was?
And I thought she must be very young. I said, do you mind me asking how old you are? And she said, I'm 47.
Oh, my God.
So I do not ever shame anybody. It just drives me more, motivates me more that people, especially our young people, they don't know who Gloria Steinem is. They don't know, you know, who Alice Paul is.
Wow.
And, you know, I do a piece in She's History about Mrs. Banks from Mary Poppins. And this was something I was trying to explain to the producer for Spectrum News, how Alice Paul was mentored in England by the famous suffragette named Emmeline Pankhurst. And now a suffragette, there's a difference between a suffragist, and I learned this from Martha Wheelock when I did my first play with her. A suffragist is someone in America who wants equal voting rights, and a suffragette, which the first time I heard that word was from David Bowie's song, right?
Yes.
And that's England. And so Emmeline Pankhurst was a suffragette, and she would go around smashing windows and get arrested and go on a hunger, went to jail, went on a hunger strike, and that worked, and they got the vote. But in Mary Poppins, if you remember Mrs. Banks, she's wearing a sash. Yes. That's it. Vote. And she sings a song, political equality and equal rights with man. Take heart, for Mrs. Pankhurst has been clapped with irons again. Wow. And I loved learning that. Like, oh, my God, Mary Poppins, Mrs. Banks, Emmeline Pankhurst. Yeah. So that, those. Are,
wow. That, yeah. That's amazing. And yeah, so there is a definite hole in our education system
who's writing the history books, who's creating the curriculum, who has been creating it all these years. So, and even in the book that I'm writing, when I talk about education and what people are learning, I'm like, well, I'm sure my book will be banned, and it will be an honor if it is, because I'm going to have Margaret Sanger in there, the mother of the birth control movement. But, you know, depending on where you go to school, what's the curriculum? As we know, Florida, you know, we can talk about all that, how awful it is that with that history, slavery. I mean, being according to DeSantis, do we want to even go there?
No.
There's a lot of benefits to being a slave.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You learn a vocation. Yeah, you could go to trade school.
Yeah. So, yes, there's not just a void, a dearth. I mean, the amount of women's history, there is practically not there at all. So,
right. So there's a need. There's a need for your book. There's a need for your plays. And
there are actually a lot of women's history books if you look for them. And Chelsea Clinton, who I have to give such props to, she has a whole series of women's history books called She Persisted. Wow. And they're for really young kids, but they're great. You know, thank God. Or as Bella Abzug would say, thank goddess.
Yes. And Amy, you made a moniker for yourself. You're a cultural historian. We should throw that in there. Good for Chelsea Clinton. I'm glad to hear that. You know, it's, and again, to circle back, here we are. It's 2024. We still don't have an Equal Rights Amendment. Meaning that women, in the eyes of this extreme Supreme Court, are unequal.
I'm not even getting started.
You know, Scalia may be dead, but his bigotry lives on.
Yeah. The Supreme Court. Yeah, that's a whole thing. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor was the first woman to be appointed to the Supreme Court in, I think it was 1986. And it was Reagan, I think. And she was conservative.
She was very conservative. Sandra Day O'Connor is the reason that George W. Bush was awarded the presidency. Yep. He didn't win it. She was the deciding vote. And for that, I have nothing but disdain for her.
I'm shocked you have disdain at all.
Are you now? Amy, you know me. You know the levels of my.
We all know you, Nicole. We all know you. We all love you, and we all need you, and we all appreciate. Thank goddess for you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I just invited you to see one of the great rock goddesses of all time, because Chrissy Hynde is touring this summer and is playing in Phoenix. But you're right, it's in August. So I understand, but that's why God invented air conditioning. It's okay. I understand. So, Amy Simon, I love that this has become your life's work. And you know, hopefully there will be a nice payday with the book. You continue doing the shows.
It's not really very much money in publishing, but that's okay. I'm still happy to do it.
Right. Well, it's rewarding. And now you have a granddaughter.
Two. I have a granddaughter and a grandson.
Right. One granddaughter, one grandson.
Actually, I just got a text from Rose. I'm hoping that I can speak to her because they're in England.
Yes.
So it's tricky, but she's a really good mother, and she knows all about the first woman to run for president. And I think I did a pretty good job.
You did. And she also knows about Cher.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And she's in the beauty business. I have two daughters. One's in the beauty business. And I haven't shared this with you, but Ruby, my younger daughter, she's in the music business. Yes. I'm going to send you something. She's working for a company called, I can't remember it, she just did a conference where it was all about including women. And she had all these statistics about how few women are behind the scenes in the music industry. So, I mean, it's not such a stretch. Both her parents were in the music business, but Ruby's a real feminist. And yeah, I believe that when Hillary lost, she like stayed in bed for 2 days. She was really depressed.
Wow. Well, I was depressed too. Not because Hillary lost, depressed. But because what happened then. And another
backwards,
day.
Backwards, going backwards.
Yes, yes. So, all right, Amy. Well, we're catching up. It is still Women's History Month for a few more days. The month ends with Gloria Steinem turning 90. What are you doing to celebrate?
I know we're at the end. I just want to say something. The Women's History Month started because of a socialist movement in Europe in like the 1870s. And then in the early 1900s, women in New York, it was all about labor rights and women's rights. And that's what started Women's History Month. And then we have Women's Equality Day, August 26th, which is the day we celebrate women winning the vote. Thank you, Bella Abzug, for making that day Women's Equality Day. And then in October 11th, we have something called International Day of the Girl. I'm actually going to write something up about this. I just haven't had time. These are like the women's history holidays. But in October 11th, it's the International Day of the Girl, which highlights the 65 million girls around the world that don't have access to education, that are still subject to violence. It's bad. We're not, when people say Happy Women's History Month, I'm always like, it's not as happy. We have a lot more to do.
They say happy, you know, happy Memorial Day. No, you know, so
right. So
any day, any holiday, just because it's a holiday doesn't mean it's a celebration.
Well, you can buy a mattress and that's always good, right?
That you can.
Something like that.
Even more so on President's Day. So go. Right. Because presidents sleep.
Oh my. And now thank goddess, I keep saying, as Bella Abzug would say, about Christopher Columbus, who I didn't realize what a son of a bitch he was until I read Howard Zim's book. And if your listeners don't know who
Howard Zinn was.
Howard Zinn.
The history of the United States.
He tells the real truth.
Yes.
Yeah, no more Columbus Day, just Native American, you know, Indigenous.
Indigenous People's Day.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do what we can. We still get it wrong on so many fronts. It's trying to correct all the mistakes that are made through the
Keep
year.
Keep fighting. Right. Keep going fighting. Don't give up. Keep as Susan B. Anthony says, failure is impossible. I like it.
Or, you know, it's all about the journey. So, you know, as long as we're moving forward, as I was bemoaning the other day, that, you know, Springsteen has a song, Two Steps Up. Or One Step Up, because he talks about one step up and two steps back. Well, you're moving in the wrong direction. If you go two steps up and one step back, at least you're making progress. So that's what I strive for.
Yeah. Well, people always tell me we've made progress. And I say, it's easy to go up when you started under the ground, but I'm happy for any progress. And we keep making progress because we just have so far to go, but keep going. I'm an optimist, a realistic optimist. That's me.
Amy Simon. Find her at sheshistory.com. And we will wait for the book. Thank you, Amy.
To be continued.
Absolutely. It's a never-ending story. Amy Simon, everyone. She is a cultural herstorian. I see people in the chat room, the YouTube chat room, saying, I love her story. It's her story, not his story. And she calls herself a cultural herstorian. Yeah, I hope you enjoyed that. I'm so sorry about the technical problems. I've been, you know, I give up. I'm now, while that was running, I am setting up the other tower PC that I have. It's an older one, but maybe that'll work better. I don't know. I'm just beside myself. I don't know what to do anymore. So let's see. We've got 5 minutes left. Am I echoing? I feel like I should just end the show now because of all this. I'll tell you what I will do. If I have it handy, I'm going to play for you a little bit of Rachel Maddow from last night, because I'm done. I'm angry and upset.
I'm trying not to think
about
it.
Hold on. I got to stop this tape from going. And so Rachel Maddow last night, I was so impressed with her. She went on for like a half hour. I mean, her setup is always like, get to the point already. I thought she was going there about Ronna McDaniel, and it turns out she was. And here's a little bit of what she had to say.
And I will also say, you know, if you care what I think about this, I will tell you the fact that Ms. McDaniel is on the payroll at NBC News, to me, that is inexplicable. I mean, you wouldn't hire a wise guy. You wouldn't hire a made man like a mobster to work at a DA's office, right? you wouldn't hire a pickpocket to work as a TSA screener. And so I find the decision to put her on the payroll inexplicable. And I hope they will reverse their decision. And it's not about, you know, Democratic Party, Republican Party. It's not about partisanship. It's not about right versus left. It's not about being a political professional versus some other kinds of person. It's not about being mean or nice to journalists. It's not about just being associated with Donald Trump and his time in the Republican Party. It's not even about lying or not lying. It's about our system of government and undermining elections and going after democracy as an ongoing project, right? And this is a difficult time for us as a country. And I think that means we need to be clear-eyed about the implications of it. Difficult times make for difficult decisions. We are contending with something we've never had to contend with before. In the news business, yes, we are covering an election, which we do all the time, but we're also covering bad actors trying to use the rights and privileges of a democracy to end democracy. The chief threat among them now is not the rioters and the kooks, but the slick political professionals who are turning their considerable talents to laundering violently revolutionary claims that America's elections aren't real, that election results aren't real, and that they shouldn't be respected. We are contending with this now, not from William Dudley Pelley's brown shirt militias, right? But from the multi-billion dollar massive political operation of one of the two governing parties of the United States of America. And that's new. And with our country up against something that daunting and that scary and that dangerous for the country, I think bad decisions will inevitably happen. Mistakes will be made. But part of our resilience as a democracy is going to be recognizing when decisions are bad ones and reversing those bad decisions. Hearing legitimate criticism, responding to it, and correcting course. Not digging in, not blaming others. Take a minute. Acknowledge that maybe it wasn't the right call. It is a sign of strength, not weakness, to acknowledge when you are wrong. It is a sign of strength. And our country needs us to be strong right now. I'll be right back.
So that's Rachel Maddow last night calling out her bosses and saying, you need to correct this. It's not enough to just say, oh, she won't be on our air here at MSNBC. You need to admit you made a mistake and move on. So today at NBC, there were apparently meetings. And the word is that the honchos at Comcast, at NBC, will reverse course and pull their offer. And the contract will be null and void, which means they won't have to pay her. So that is the right decision. Yesterday on this program, I asked Jonathan Larson, the fucking news guy, if he thought Rachel would address it, and he didn't even want to speculate. I thought she would, but not to the extent that she did. And for that, for her strength in the message, for her forceful denunciation of the powers that be over there, and for putting it all in context. Usually I bemoan her lengthy intros. In this case, it worked. It was perfect. So thank you, Rachel Maddow. I appreciate it. And you, thank you for bearing with me on the sound today. I guess I have my work cut out for me tonight again. I've been spending a lot more time in the studio than I like to this week, but I'll be messing around with computers again tonight. We have Barbara McQuaid on this program live tomorrow, confirmed. Now I just need to make sure the equipment works. Good luck to me. And if it doesn't, then I give up. All right. Peace out, everyone.